I'm Mark Gandy for CFO Bookshelf. Anna has a bright legal mind. She's trading in the billable hour to be an in-house lawyer at Denison Real Estate. It's a regional real estate firm in the Midwest. And life is a bit slower in pace, but there are challenges in her new job. Contracts are in file cabinets all over the building, so documents are not digitized. She's viewed still as an outsider and not as a trusted advisor. And she also works for a boss that's about one thing, save me money. Now, I'm not interviewing Anna because, well, she's not a real person. Peter Karyanis invented her in his book, Corporate Counsel. He uses a smart and clever story arc to teach what it's like for an attorney to transition from a law firm to a private business. Anyone working in business can learn from this book. You want to build your legal literacy and acumen? Well, this is a good place to start. The book is Corporate Counsel. My guest again is the author of this five-star book, Peter Karyanis, and this is CFO Bookshelf. Again, my guest is Peter Karyanis, who has worked in big law before taking a position as an in-house general counsel of a growing tech company in the real estate industry. I started my conversation with Peter by reading him two quotes. Here is the first one, and it's about being an in-house lawyer. He says, it's often extremely gratifying, rewarding, and an enjoyable career. And here is the second quote. Quote number two from your book, ask yourself why lawyers are leaving law firms. Ask yourself why companies are hiring lawyers. And again, I'm already biased toward the concept of in-house lawyers. Let's hear your origin story and how you moved toward the in-house lawyering. And of course, now you're doing something differently, which I think is cool, but what's the start? What's your story?
I graduated from law school in the mid 90s. I went to law school in the U.S. and in Canada. I am Canadian. I'm based in Toronto, but I studied in the U.S. As well. And I'm licensed on both sides of the border. And when I started my career as a young attorney in the mid 90s, I think I started my first job around 1997, summer of 97. It was fairly conventional. I worked in one of the national law firms in Canada and stayed there for a number of years. It was in the context of working in a conventional law firm and working with in-house lawyers as my clients or as collaborators or sometimes on opposite sides of a transaction it really opened my eyes to a wider career, wider opportunities. And at that point, I would say I wouldn't have been able to recognize it at the time in the 90s, but the beginning of an evolution of what in-house counsel was. There had been in-house lawyers for many, many years prior to the 90s. But I think it's safe to say that it was often viewed as, and this is going to sound a little bit negative, but sometimes a lawyer who couldn't cut it in private practice. And so they went in-house. And that may have been the case in the 60s or 70s. I don't have a strong opinion. I was too young to know. But by the 90s, it was actually turning. And you could see that the in-house lawyer was creating value inside the company. So I was in private practice for a number of years. And then I left. And at that time, I left with this concept of being able to be a fractional lawyer, a fractional in-house lawyer at a number of different companies. And that was 2004. And I worked in that way for a number of years before I then founded my law firm, Conduit Law, in 2012, which was really dedicated to that premise of embedding in-house counsel on demand as fractional lawyers with small to mid-sized companies. And I did that for a number of years.
In your book is Corporate Counsel, and I want to applaud you. You use fiction to get your points across. And yes, I read a lot of books. Sometimes I read upwards to 120 to 130 books a year. And I've read my share of really bad books. I've read my share of books where authors tried to tell a fictional story. You nailed it. So I'm curious, Peter, can I ask the question, did you get some help on the fiction? Because the characters are believable. There's nothing cheesy. There's a term in Missouri. This is not Homerish. This is good writing. Did you have some help at least?
I did. I did have some help. So I had some help in a few different ways. The interesting thing about that is the start of the book didn't actually, in its original inception, it wasn't going to take this this road, if you will, of a fable to describe the business truths around it, or the business proposition. What I found was in my first draft, I just found even what I was writing was so deathly boring that it was boring to me. And I thought, well, if I'm at the beginning stages of writing my book and it doesn't grab my attention, there's zero chance it's going to grab anybody else's attention. And so I stopped. I was working with a writing coach. A friend of mine has a company that helps authors self-publish. And I contacted them, and they were invaluable, particularly in helping me with getting it onto Amazon and all the details around that, which, to be honest, I would have been completely lost trying to stick handle those details. But I was working with a writing coach, and he did a fantastic job. I greatly appreciated his effort and his input and his guidance. But we locked heads at the very beginning, because on the topic of using fiction, everybody said I was picking the harder way to go about it, that I should really stick to my knitting and keep it as straightforward as possible. It's a business book. It's going to be about business. And, you know, are people really going to want this fable? And my view was, some of the best business books, in suspended quotation marks, that I had read had actually taken, had used this this model and had used the fable story. And then I stepped back and thought, well, everybody loves a good story. And, you know, Aesop's fables are timeless, not at all to compare what I did to anybody like Aesop. But I thought that it might be easier to try to distill these truths, or distill the lessons, and perhaps truths is overstating it, but distill these lessons into some kind of a story that could grab people's attention. And then we organized the book so that, as you know, there's the key takeaways in each chapter. So if someone really is interested, they can read the whole thing, start to finish, no problem. If they just want to focus in on a few chapters, they can see from those chapters what they are. If they like the fable and they don't care about the takeaways, they can read the front half and not the back half. And if they really just want the Cliff Notes versions, they can go to the key takeaways.
And I will just say, I read this book in one sitting. Think about that. That's how good this book was. So I would suggest to the average reader, just read it from beginning to end. Don't forget to read the preface, the introduction, because that's critical, because there's some important points. In fact, those quotes I read from at the beginning are from the very beginning, before chapter one. So again, I read it in one sitting. Again, that's how good this book is. By the way, you've got some really good frameworks in this book. For example, you have what's called the star pyramid. Got this mixed up. You've got the STAR framework, STARR. By the way, did you know I looked that up? It's like, is this new? Have I not heard of this? And no, that appears to be, that's your framework. I call it the pyramid of work, which I think will hit. And you need to come up with some little trademark. Give that a name, that pyramid. You have the four C's of limited resources. There's the risk. I call it the risk mental model, which, by the way, is phenomenal. Every CFO that I work with, controller or chief operating officer, they need to know this risk middle model that you bring up in the latter part of the book. So again, the frameworks are simple, and again, this stuff is just sticky as you read it. So let's jump into the book. I could easily do all the talking here. That would be wrong. I love Anna. She is a great character. I'll even tell you my favorite line in the book from Anna, and it's not in the last chapter. But tell us
what
a little. Oh, you want me to tell you? Well, so
you piqued my interest.
So Anna, I'll just explain real quickly. She's the protagonist. She's left. She's like you. She's left the big, we'll call it Jones Day of the world. She's left. She's gone into work for a regional size real estate organization. And she learns that I need to get out, visit the other corporate offices. When she's visiting a corporate office in St. Louis, Missouri, which is about 2 hours from me, she runs into someone. I can't remember who she talked to, but the person she talked to, her daughter wants to be an attorney. And she said, hey, would it be okay if you would maybe give her some advice from time to time? Guess what Anna does? You'll never believe, Peter, you'll never believe what Anna did in the story.
What did she do?
She took the phone number or she gave a phone number. She said, she can call me anytime she wants. I thought there you go, Anna. I like this person a lot. It's one of my favorite. I know that's a itty bitty little thing. I love that about Anna. Does that surprise?
Well, Anna she's a great personality, a great character. A few people have asked me is Anna a real person? She's not, but she is most certainly an amalgam. And not just of me either, but an amalgam of many, many attorneys that I've worked with over the years. The story, the arc, if you will, of her story is one of starting in private practice and then moving in house. And for a variety of reasons, this is a very well-worn path now. I don't know that, I don't think anybody would find that controversial. But I thought that it was a very interesting moment in her professional career. That's why I started the book off at that moment as she's making the difference. Because, you know, when we go to law school and you graduate and you're a lawyer and you pass the bar, let's say, I've always said I never knew more law than like the day after I wrote the bar exam. And then immediately after that, it started to drop precipitously. But, you know, there's an odd thing about the way legal education and legal licensing is done in the U.S. and other countries as well. They call you a lawyer and you're licensed to do everything. And you sit for the bar exam and you take criminal law and real estate law and property law, constitutional law, and theoretically you could do anything. Your license isn't limited. But of course we all know much better than that, and that one lawyer is not the same as the other lawyer, and what a real estate lawyer does for a living doesn't look at all like what a litigator does for a living, and we could go on and on down the road. And I think that also applies to the difference between being an attorney in private practice and being an attorney who's working in-house. It is a different kind of job. It is a different kind of job description. And there are some very unique components to that. And a lot of people don't think of it before they jump in to an in-house role. They learn about it over time, but they don't think. They just think, well, I was a lawyer in private practice here. Now I'm going to be a lawyer in-house. I'm just going to be lawyering. It's not the same.
Anna's first observation, the files were a disorganized mess. Nothing was properly filed, stored, or archived. The original contracts were all over the place, filled with neither rhyme nor reason. Before bringing her office into the 21st century, she would have to drag them into the 20th century. By the way, that is brilliant writing. Is this the norm for the Annas of the world? Was this the way it was when you jumped into the private world a private company?
Yeah, it was, and I may have been taking a little bit of license with Anna's story there. I'm sure there are a lot of companies where it's not quite a disorganized mess. And I would also say, you know, when I made the move from private practice to in-house, there was far fewer software tools that there are today to help manage those kinds of things. But that having been said, I think there are countless lawyers who go in-house and need to find the contracts, and they are in the functional equivalent of a black filing cabinet. And or the eDrive on the server. And they're not categorized in terms of, you know, size, materiality, counterparty, expiration date, renewal date, potential risk. There's just a big disorganized mess. And that would be the case for many, many businesses, particularly businesses that haven't had the benefit of a good in-house team to frankly bring order to that.
Well, I love the line, Peter, because since 2001, I've touched about 140 small business owners ranging from 2 million in revenue to upwards to 160. Jim, Sarah, Kate, Ann, Bill, I need to see this contract. I need to see this one document. Sometimes it takes a week, Peter. So this line, it resonated. I want to make one other quick observation. It's more of a question. This is an opinion. Now, again, we're going to go back to fractional lawyering, and I hope we're not deviating from the book, but I have a strong opinion, and I just want you to either push back or say, no, this is a great idea. I would say any business, and I don't want to put a limit on the revenue, but I guess we could say at least 5 million and more. Doesn't it make sense for every small business to at least go through a legal audit, maybe every couple of years, just to make sure all the documents are in order? In the United States, where we have S corporations, I don't know what the equivalent is of an S corporation up in Canada, but I'm here to tell you, buy-sell agreements are generally a train wreck that need to be rewritten. Doesn't it make sense for every small business to be exposed to a legal audit just to get their corporate governance in line?
Oh, I couldn't agree more. You know, contracts are, in a manner of speaking, they're living documents, right? They're you know, it's a piece of paper with words on it that really is supposed to govern a relationship. And when things are going well and the relationship is going well and business is good, you know, to be honest, people don't really look at the contract that much. They really just look at the contract when it's a problem. And frankly, the last thing you want to do is be reaching into the filing cabinet and looking at a contract that no one has looked at in 5 years. Why do I say this? Well, first of all, you may not even be honoring the terms of the contract as it is. There may be, let's say, delivery terms that over the years have evolved. And what we thought we were going to do 5 years ago, well, then a couple of years in, you know, then COVID happened and we changed how we're interacting with one another. And then we continue, but we never thought to amend the contract. I think it's a very strong discipline. I would agree with you 100%. I think it's a very strong discipline that periodically all the contracts should be looked at. I'm always very leery of very long-term contracts. I know that business owners and entrepreneurs are excited when they can get a long-term renewing contract, and I get it. There's very good reason to like that model and to celebrate that success. But 5 years is a long time. So every 2 years, every 3 years, it's a very good discipline to look at the contracts and understand what worked then, what works now, how we want to change. It also is a good way of addressing the risk, the portfolio of risk in the business. And part of what I say in the book is that you do need to have an understanding of risk tolerance and risk mitigation. Very, very important difference to the in-house lawyer.
Going back to contracts, again, there are so many nuggets, so many gems in this book. One of them, the concept of contract playbooks. this concept was genius. Could you explain that real quickly, what Anna did in creating a contract playbook?
So, you know, we've come a long way in terms of putting these playbooks in place. When I first did this in the early 2000s, we didn't really call it a playbook. The term's become commonplace now in the industry. But when I went in-house, I was working with a company. It was a real estate IT company. And their core business was licensing data. And they had a very vigorous, very robust, very detailed contract. It was 17 pages long. And it was actually an impediment to getting deals done. They would sell their customers on an idea, and the customer would be ready to take it, ready to start getting the license data. And then the sales guy would reach into his briefcase and pull out a 17-page contract. And the other side would just freak out. They say, oh, my lawyer has to look at this. Park that for a moment, that 17-page contract that nobody could understand, with the next one, which was the sales guys at the end of the month, at the end of the quarter, always trying to get deals done. And they'd be coming to my desk very late in the day, very late in the week, very late in the month, saying, can we accept these terms? Can we accept these terms? Can we accept these terms? Well, a lot of times we really didn't have time to think about it. And the reflex, and lawyers know this, but the reflex would be to say, no, we're not changing our terms. And sometimes the in-house lawyer becomes known as, you know, Dr. No, or the Department of No. Well, that we're not going to make any money if we just say no. We need to learn how to sell what we sell and accept terms that we think are reasonable. So what I did with the playbook was to say, well, here's a bunch of clauses. Here are a few clauses that are absolute deal breakers. Do not come to me and try to negotiate a change to these terms, because we won't change them. But here are some other clauses that we will accept different positions. Why don't we document them and give that to the salespeople, so that instead of the salespeople not knowing what would or would not be acceptable to negotiate, they would already come to the meeting with me saying, you know, here's our standard term, and I got them to agree to, you know, fallback position number one, at which point I could just say, perfect, let's make the change and let's move on. Or if the counterparty was trying to make changes to the provision that was itself a non-negotiable, a deal breaker, as it were, the sales guy could push back and say, look, I already know our legal department's not going to agree to that change. That's a deal-breaking provision. And so what the playbook was intended to do was to educate our internal stakeholders, in that particular case, the sales team, about the nature of the clauses, and educate them as to why they were important, but then empower them by giving them alternatives, and as well as the language that would be accepted, so that if it was the end of the week, the end of the month, the end of the quarter, the sales team could actually come to us with contracts that we could readily accept, readily revise, and have them signed on time, which meant it was a success for everybody.
The arc in the book, the story arc is simple and it's clever. The story arc is Anna's first 100 days. So I was really nosy. When you stepped in, when you left the big law firm and went to work for a company, did you have that idea, that concept of first 100 days?
Nope, not at all. And it's something that at that time that I didn't have the experience with, or maybe the professional background or the acumen or the understanding. And I certainly did not understand. You know, I have a bias to action. That's my personality. Let's just get it done. Let's roll up our sleeves and let's start doing the work right away. And that probably would have been my approach back then. Now I think there is great benefit in slowing down. You're always going to get very busy in your new position. But it's kind of like that expression, you only get one chance to make a first impression. You'll only be new in the job. You'll only be new in the role once and for a brief period in time. And that brief period of time there's a few things you could do. You could start just trying to get yourself real busy as fast as possible. And maybe that's fine for other people. In my view, I think that that time is a luxury. It will disappear, you know, a month, 2 months, 3 months from now, you'll be, you know, back at into the grind. But to take advantage of the extra time you have at the start of a position, in this case, the first 100 days, to really understand the business, to understand the stakeholders, to understand the industry, to understand important nuances to the business, I think it's invaluable. And you only really get one opportunity to do that.
I have three bullet point takeaways with this first 100 days, in addition to learning the organization you're serving. Takeaway number one is the first 100 days, you're still focusing on day-to-day work. I mean, when you, that first day, there's probably work to be done right now. There may be a contract negotiation going on right now. So Anna probably spent, we don't know, anywhere from 4 to 6 hours, sometimes maybe 8 hours a day, just doing the daily work. So that first 100 days, you still have to do the work, right? That's takeaway number.
Absolutely.
Takeaway number two is she had a great assistant. Her and her assistant were on the same page. I don't know what you do in coaching when someone's thinking about taking an in-house position, but I have a feeling that if not now, I bet you will in the future, I bet you are, find out who will be working for you and is their heart in it. Are they willing to make some changes? Anna got lucky. She had someone who is all in, bought in. And then my last takeaway on this first 100 days, we haven't talked about Jack yet, which, by the way, this is clever what you did. We don't want to give any spoilers. I'll just say Jack and John, Jack and John. And I'm smiling as I say this, but Jack was a kind of a sage, this good sounding board that Anna met across the street at a small restaurant where she worked at, and her and Jack would talk. And so those three little things, along with the first 100 days, I would just say, hopefully you're going to have a sounding board. And for some people, that may be you being that sounding board. So again, I loved the concept of the first 100 days.
Yeah, I think it's a powerful, it's a powerful tool. Going back to her assistant, Anna's assistant, her name is Ruth.
Right.
And I picked that name on purpose. The meaning of that name is friend or companion. And I really wanted to set up in my mind, as I was writing it, a relationship of a more equal relationship, a greater partner relationship. And so the name was very purposeful when I chose Ruth as a name. And you know, we do definitely not want to spoil anything for those of you that might read the book, because they're in the fictional tale of Anna as she changes her career. There are a few little surprises built in.
Yes.
But part of it was, and this was done very purposefully, was adapting the concept of the hero's journey. And with Anna being the hero of the story, the protagonist of the story. And it's really, in many respects, a journey of self-discovery. And the hero's journey is as old as campfires and storytelling might be. And that was purposefully done to try to bring in the reader into that idea, into the story, into the self-discovery. And in many cases, hopefully, the lawyers who would read it, they would see themselves in Anna.
And every hero has to face conflict. And the conflict that she encountered was a guy named David. I want to read something from the book. David is the CEO. He runs the organization. He took it over from his father, so he's a second generation owner. David has the big time degree. He's probably runs the business by the numbers. So he's just all business. And I would say he's a person of action. But David, here's what you say about David in the book, the CEO. The problem is that David didn't really want a new and modern general counsel. He wanted an in-house lawyer who would do what she was told, not ask a lot of questions or rock the boat. Peter, sir, what's your best advice for any CEO in North America and even globally around the globe? What's the best advice that you can give to them as they're thinking about bringing on an in-house general counsel?
It's a tremendous opportunity and a point of inflection for the company to be able to bring that kind of legal skill in-house as opposed to having it externally. And the reason is at least twofold. First of all, having the lawyers in-house with the right lawyer and the right team, all of this, of course, goes without saying, that will accelerate your business, accelerate your time to contract, accelerate your ability to actually generate revenue if you have the right team in place. But one of the other key differences is that lawyers are about risk. I mean, ultimately, we manage risk in the world. Bringing that in-house lawyer into your company means that individual is going to have a very real and informed view of what the risks are of that business because they're living in it. Well, if you've got somebody with those skills and abilities, if you brought them in-house and trained them up and now given them insight into what the risk profile of the company is, you've put them side by side with the revenue generators in the business so that they understand how the company actually makes money. Well, my humble advice to those CEOs would be let them do their job. Surround yourself with the best possible people. But then don't handcuff them. Don't keep them in first gear. Let them do their job. And I think that's a little bit about Dave. David didn't really understand what a great resource he had in Anna. David didn't understand that it was that she could do more to help the business, not just what he considered to be maybe the stereotypical ways that a lawyer might protect the business, that in fact she could enable the business to move forward and faster. And I don't think David really, I tried to put it in the book in a way that it was really a discovery for David. It wasn't really so much a decision. He just hadn't really thought about it that way.
Precisely. And again, that line I just read was one of my favorite lines in the book because, again, he hired her for the wrong reason. Again, no spoilers. I will just say, he changed pretty quickly after that. There's an event that occurs that is believable. It's an interesting, in fact, what you brought into the book near the end, I wasn't expecting it. I thought, oh, we got some intense drama here, but it was also very, very real. I'm anxious for people that I recommend this book to. I can't wait to ask them, what did you think of the ending? Legal operations. So we've had Gene Kim on the book. One of my favorite fictional books that's business oriented is The Phoenix Project. By the way, I think it'd be good if you even read The Phoenix Project if you haven't, because to me, there's some overlap between DevOps and legal ops. In fact, Gene's going to be back on the show here in a couple of weeks, and I'm even going to mention your book to him. He's going to smile because he's saying, I see DevOps in this legal world, but I have a question, or it's more of a comment, an observation about attorneys coming to work in-house. So in the past, they were focused on the billable hour. Stay billable. That's the name of the game. Now they come in-house and, oh my gosh, I got to run a budget. Paperless. I'm in charge of doing that. If we're not paperless yet, you bring up the concept of revenue generator, which you again, you pointed out it came from, I think you used DuPont, maybe it was one of the first organizations to the legal department to be a revenue generator in the organization. In your opinion, Peter, what's the biggest issue of these attorneys going to work in-house that it takes them a while to wrap their arms around? I would think just managing a budget may be an issue, but what's the biggest challenge once they come on?
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think managing a budget and understanding how that budget interacts with other parts of the firm is important. I think one of there's a bit of a psychological recognition that has to go with that. When lawyers are in their law firms, they are the revenue producers. They are the heart of the business. In a law firm, the people that make money, there's an array of professionals around them. It's really, we no longer just talk about the lawyer and non-lawyers. That terminology is antiquated and not that helpful. But still, fundamentally, in a law firm, the fee earners that generate the revenue are part of the business. As soon as you go in-house, you are no longer that. Now, whatever that business might be, if they make widgets or if they license technology or if they manage real estate buildings, whatever they are, that's the core part of their business. And everybody else, including the lawyer, is arrayed around that core part of the business. Everybody now supports the core part of the business. And for lawyers, sometimes that's a bit of a transition in their thinking. They need to understand that they're not central to the business. What is central to the business is how the business makes money. And the question is then, how does the legal department support that?
Every hero's journey has a guide. Jack, whom we talked about, is the guide, the gray beard, the sounding board to Anna. And if I'm not mistaken, Peter, correct me if I'm wrong, he may have been the person to help to pull back the curtains that you are a peer partner. So in this whole concept of legal ops, at some point that attorney or lawyer is going to realize, hey, I'm not just a resource, but I'm a peer-partner. And I just thought, again, brilliant writing, brilliant teaching, brilliant coaching and mentoring in this book. That's not really a question. I'm just saying I love the concept of peer partner.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You break down risk into three simple buckets. Could you share what those are?
Yeah. Manage, mitigate, allocate.
And it's so simple. And with those buckets, you've got regular business risk, and then you've got regulatory risk, and then you've got reputational risk. And then what you just said, I call those the three verbs. Those are your three verbs at your disposal. And I would even say with a lot of the CEOs I work with today, they don't realize, well, what should we manage? What should we ignore? What should we transfer to somebody else, like an insurance organization? So again, the whole discussion on risk, even for someone like me, was a welcome refresher.
This has been one of the areas in my career that I've struggled with at different times, and really had to focus on, particularly in understanding how to advise our corporate clients. You know, what is the lawyer's relationship to risk, and also a key understanding, and I have to talk, when I talk to junior lawyers, we often discuss this, which is who gets to make the call on risk. And it's the client. It's the client's decision. Because ultimately risk is also profit, right? That's for the companies that are willing to assume risk, this is where they will make their profit. And sometimes some companies are willing to assume more risk, do something riskier in order to make more money. And what I think is important for lawyers to understand is our job isn't to decide whether it's a good risk or a bad risk. I mean, obviously there are certain risks that we might say, absolutely you shouldn't do that. Shouldn't commit a crime, by way of an example. But, you know, assuming that the business is entirely legal, our job is to explain to our clients what the risks are and what the potential range of consequences are. Nobody has a crystal ball, and so we can't perfectly forecast the future by any stretch of the imagination, but certainly we can use our professional judgment to understand risk. And then properly empower the business to make an informed decision. And then our job is then to take that decision and those instructions and bring it to life.
Some of my peers and I used to joke about our in-house legal department that they're trying to eliminate risks. So even though they're some of the smartest people I ever worked with, one of my biggest frustrations was I just feel like they're trying to eliminate risk. Yeah, you can do that, but there's a cost. And I love the concept of just educate me on the risk that I may not be aware of. Have my 6 o'clock on what I don't know. So I think sometimes education is just as good as actually taking actions to eliminate it. And again, you made a great comment about risk can mean money, which by the way, is in the book. So again, I love this section. A couple of quick definitions. I had to look these up because I'm from a hick town in Missouri in the U.S. ALSPs and MLSs. ALSPs, MLSs. And I may not be the only one who's not familiar with these types of organizations. Could you explain what they are and where they come into play?
Yeah, sure. So ALSPs are alternative legal service providers. And MLS is managed legal services. Sometimes it's LMS, legal managed services. And to be honest, on terms of definitions on that, if you talk to 10 lawyers in the business, you might get 10 different definitions. But in the case of ALSPs first, so, and this is evolving very quickly. Soon, I think we can take the A out of it as they won't be considered alternative. But historically, you know, if you needed legal advice and you needed a lawyer, you had to go to a law firm, period, full stop. And what's happened all across the English-speaking world and all the common law jurisdictions, US, Canada, Australia, UK, is that there are a number of different types of law companies have grown up where they have lawyers. But in addition to lawyers, they may have other tech, other professionals involved, other like IT professionals, finance professionals, and a variety of other ones. And they're able to provide advice to clients. Now, historically, you could only get legal advice from a law firm. In some jurisdictions, that is no longer the case. It hasn't been the case for many years. And so the ALSP has grown as a category. And what we put in, I put the concept of the ALSP in the book is really just to underline to anybody in-house that if they're not making a conscious decision to understand how they should be outsourcing work and where they should be outsourcing work to, then they're probably doing their company a disservice. And if they're only going to a traditional law firm and not considering the alternative solutions that are in the marketplace, in my opinion, they're certainly doing the company a disservice because there are ways that companies can benefit from getting these other services.
Even though it's not a term, a unique term, I still wrote it down. The moral authority, the moral authority, not the CEO, not the CFO, not the COO, not the director of marketing, the in-house lawyer is the moral authority. Peter, why?
Yeah, I listen, I'm open to debating this topic with many people, and there probably are some alternative views, but my thinking is the following. All attorneys, they're members of their local bar association. In order to get their bar and get their ticket punched, they swore an oath. I think there's a Seinfeld sketch or stand-up piece where he says lawyers are like they're like the people when you're playing Monopoly who've actually turned the book upside down and or turned the Monopoly box upside down and read the rules. We're those people. Well, if we've taken an oath before the bar to protect and uphold the law, if we are licensed members of a local bar association, and if we're going to be true to our company, we need to be, as in-house counsel, the moral authority of the business. Because if people see us cutting corners, if people see us not following and respecting the law, if people see in-house lawyers taking liberties, then the rest of the company will do the exact same thing. Now, I know that people will say often tone comes from the top, and I don't disagree with that. However, there's a very powerful role for an in-house counsel to play to ensure that they are the moral authority of the business, and that at least on their watch, that that they will not be used or have their legal services used in order to somehow break the law. It's very important. And when people lose sight of it, and there are countless cases, but when in-house lawyers lose sight of their responsibility, mistakes are always made, and oftentimes people go to jail.
I did not read your concepts of the moral authority as an absolute. I read it as a guiding principle. So if you have people debate you about this, again, I view this as just a guiding principle, because these in-house attorneys, they are going to be a moral compass. And by the way, I clearly delineate between ethics and being a moral compass or authority, because you can be ethical and not moral. So again, I view this as a strong guiding principle. So I loved the concept. I don't think I have permission to bring this up. Your book ends with a bang. There's a certain type of issue that comes up, and maybe in private, I'll ask you where you got the idea for the last chapter, but the last chapter is very good. It's relevant. It's real. It could happen to anybody. There's nothing hokey about it. So I just want to, that will cause people to hopefully want to read the book, because again, the last chapter, it definitely ended on a bang.
Well, and in fact, it's based loosely on a real life event, not that I handled as a lawyer, but that I was aware of in my professional capacity as a lawyer. I sanitized it to ensure to protect the parties who were involved, but it's real life, and it's a real example of where in-house counsel can rise to the fore.
You end the book, the very last line, she's talking to Jack, and he asks something, I'll paraphrase, what are you going to do now? Is there a sequel? Is there something we don't know? Because I read that last line that, this sounds like there could be another book. Was that on purpose, or was that just accidental, the way that very last line of the book occurred?
No, because I enjoyed learning about Anna and her story. And so I thought I would at least leave the door open for another iteration of this at some point.
If you do, will you reach out? I would love to be the person who interviews you first after you write, if you write book number two.
Yeah, no, I'd be pleased to. Thank you. You're very kind.
Are you a reader? And if so, what are some of your all-time favorite books?
Yeah, so I am a reader. I think I used to read a little bit more before than I do now, but I've always got a few books on the go. And you did give me a heads up that this would be the case, but I thought I would, for the listeners out there, there might be some lawyer listeners that might be interested in legal specific books, but for the general audience, there might be other books that don't necessarily need to be as specific to lawyers. But on the law side, I think The Firm of the Future, Tomorrow's Lawyers, The Future of the Professions, and The Great Legal Reformation are probably at the top of my list. And if I had to pick one, I'd say Tomorrow's Lawyers. And I've probably bought about 50 copies of that book, and I give them out to law students, and I just tell them, if you want to know what your career could look like, read this book. So Tomorrow's Lawyers. In terms of business books, I love the fables. And as you know, I mean, I wrote this book in the voice of a fable. The Wealthy Barber was probably the first business fable that I ever read. And it's a classic, right? The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari, The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, Who Moved My Cheese, The Go-Giver. Those were all books that, you know, I frankly read in one or two sittings, and I really liked them. You've probably seen them in the bookstores of airports all over the place. And if you haven't read them, I'd strongly recommend it. And then on the non-law side, there's a few that I really have enjoyed over the years. One of them is The Innovator's Dilemma. I think it's there's a tremendous amount of insight built into that book. I enjoyed Start With Why, Atomic Habits, The Checklist Manifesto. If anybody hasn't read The Checklist Manifesto, I strongly recommend that. This Is Lean is fantastic. And The Fat Smoker. Those were books that I thought were pretty impactful in the way that they were written.
You've wrote a book on lean. Throw in The Phoenix Project. And when you read it, you're going to do this anyway, but you're going to read it under the lens of a in-house lawyer, or pretend like you're back being an in-house lawyer. And it's like, how does this apply to my world? And how could I have been a benefit to the rest of the team? It's brilliant writing. And by the way, it has thousands and thousands of reviews. I mean, Gene Kim, great personality, great guy, easy to talk to, very giving person, but just incredibly smart. I'm anxious for you to, I want to get your opinions on that book, but it's in the form of a novel.
Well, I think that'll be one of the books that I pick up this weekend.
This is a 5-star book. It's only 159 pages. It goes fast. Even if you're not ready to hire an in-house attorney, this book is valuable. I will be recommending this book to every CEO, whether they're ready for an in-house or not. CFOs, whether they have an in-house attorney or not, there are a lot of people that can learn from this book just as it is. So I applaud the book on numerous fronts. You did a brilliant job. Your coach deserves a high five as well. So again, you are outstanding, sir.
Well, thank you very much. It's kind of you to say. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about the book, and I got to be honest, this interview has been a highlight. You've done a great job, and your podcast is fantastic. So you should be very proud of that.
You are listening to CFO Bookshelf, lifelong learning for financial leaders. And now back to our host, Mark Gandy.
There at the end, Peter mentioned Strategy and The Fat Smokers by David Maister. There's a line in the book. It goes like this: we need structures that don't squash flexibility and creativity, but minimize inefficiency and confusion. That's precisely what Anna and her small department did in the fictional real estate firm and corporate counsel. I hope you read and like the book as much as I did. Let me know what you think about it on LinkedIn. Guys, we need to call this a wrap. I'm Mark Gandy for CFO Bookshelf.